This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new study found that dog breed is not a strong predictor of dog personality. We'll take a look at those findings, and we want to hear what you have to say. If you match up with that finding, let us know right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, this month, thousands of college students in Wisconsin will cross the commencement stage, toss their caps, and trade campus life for new careers. As Rich Kramer reports, their prospects may be the best they've been in a decade.
The final months before college graduation can be a time of anxious job searches and streams of outgoing resumes. That's not the case for University of Wisconsin River Falls senior Nisi Obasi. The computer science and economics double major accepted an offer in August to become an investment analyst with Deutsche Bank in New York.
Now I've had the chance to really enjoy senior year without having that on my back.
Her advice to other students who may still be looking? Don't be afraid to counter an offer because you may have the upper hand.
I feel like negotiation skills, not a lot of people have them. So if you're given an offer for 100K, you just take it. You can get that to 120 and maybe throw on something on top if you just negotiate.
A spring survey by the National Association of Colleges and Employers shows businesses planning to boost college grad recruitment by more than 30% this year. That's the sharpest year-to-year increase in at least a decade.
This is an even hotter period for recruiters than they thought it was going to be in the fall.
Josh Kahn is assistant director of research for the group. He says recruiters are keenly aware of increasing competition for college grads. Their average starting salary is projected to top $50,000.
They know that they need to make good offers. They know that they need to raise wages and benefits to make attractive offers, competitive offers.
Taylor Schmidt-Franz is a senior at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire who landed a teaching job in April, just one day after her first interview.
February, March is kind of freaking out a little bit because I'm like, what am I doing with my life? Like, where am I going to live and all that stuff? But it feels really good. I feel ready to graduate now.
Even for seniors like UW-Eau Claire's Hannah Leah, graduating without a job offer isn't that scary.
It's a really big job market right now, so I'm not really too concerned, especially because there's like a teacher shortage and they're paying people to go back to school to become teachers because they need them so bad.
Sam Mattson considers himself one of the lucky ones. The UW-Eau Claire senior says he was asked to stay on after finishing up a student teaching job at a middle school in the city.
I think the biggest problem I have with it is you get into the classroom some more and you have current teachers that have been there for a long time saying, are you sure? Are you 100% positive? So you're second-guessing yourself more than you are the economy at this rate.
The national unemployment rate for those with at least a four-year degree was 2% in March. The unemployment rate for those with high school diplomas was twice that. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York reported a record pay gap last year of $22,000 between those with bachelor degrees and those without.
With a college degree, your ability deployed is greatly enhanced.
That's Jim Kwopik, district director for international talent recruiting company Robert Half.
Many employers are getting out ahead of the graduating class, and they're locking students in well before they graduate, unlike it's ever been.
But college enrollment has fallen since 2020. Elise Gould with the Economic Policy Institute says the pandemic added new roadblocks for many minority and lower income potential students who may not have been able to come up with tuition.
That's just not accessible to many people across the country.
As the race to recruit college students heats up, those watching the trends expect things to cool, though they're not sure how or when. In the meantime, those nearing graduation appear to be calling the shots in today's hiring economy, and they know it. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Starbucks announced earlier this May that it will increase wages and training for non-unionized workers at corporate-owned locations. A growing number of Starbucks shops around the country are voting to unionize, including two spots in Wisconsin, Oak Creek and Plover, both of which officially voted last Friday. The union Starbucks Workers United said in April that any benefits that specifically exclude unionized employees would be illegal. The group has filed more than 80 claims against Starbucks to the National Labor Relations Board so far. Starbucks is just one company, but a big one, and there's a lot of attention on the drive to unionize the coffee shops and what it could all mean for the rest of the labor market. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been involved in a union or an organizing effort or as management negotiating with a union or a unionizing campaign? Are you part of this Starbucks story here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Childers is a professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, starting on this specific bit of news, the Starbucks owner, Howard Schultz, saying, yeah, we're going to have a wage increase and special training, but only for the non-unionized shop. So what do you make of that?
Well, again, I'm not sure that he's exactly quoted correctly, and I'm not sure which piece. I know there was a piece back in the Wall Street Journal in April. That would clearly be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act, because the NLRA spells out pretty clearly that during the period where a union may be organizing, to either threaten employees with adverse consequences or to promise benefits if they reject a union is absolutely against the law.
Right. That's the New York Times reported that Starbucks was saying they would raise pay at corporate-owned spots. They would not apply to the recently unionized stores. But the company says, well, hold on. We can't unilaterally change conditions because they're unionized stores. Would that be an argument they could make?
So I think we've got to get a little bit into the weeds before we can get back between the lines. But the bottom line is that's actually sort of similar to this claim that's being made by the hospital board in terms of why they say they can't quote unquote bargain with the nurses, right? There's nothing that prevents bosses and workers from meeting and conferring. And again, there's nothing statutorial that would prevent them from offering the same benefits to these corporate stores that they are to the corporate stores who have conducted these union votes or the ones who have filed for election. It would only be illegal if they did it explicitly to try and influence the actions of the workers, either trying to organize or prior to when the vote occurs. So no, there's nothing illegal. I mean, again, think back to even when COVID flared up and for example, many people in the supply chain, grocery workers, for example, got hazard pay or bonus pay or heroes pay, however you wanted to frame it. Those are raises that were given in areas where there's collective bargaining. And again, that's a mandatory item of bargaining, but it's usually the case that a union is not going to reject when their workers are being offered more wages.
Now, zooming out a little bit, Starbucks is a big, high-profile company. Their individual shops, though, are pretty small, and we have this one-store-at-a-time unionization effort. It's getting a lot of attention, I think, just because of the prominence of the company. How big a part of the story of labor today in the United States is an organizing effort like this one at Starbucks?
Oh, I think it definitely contributes to the zeitgeist. And I mean, don't forget, we actually had the Colectivo mm-hmm. workers with their Colectivo Collective, which actually is credited with inspiring the workers at the Buffalo Starbucks, who kind of got the ball rolling nationally. And yes, I think it absolutely encourages workers from the perspective that they see that, wait, you know, we could actually form a union here and then get the opportunity to be confer with the boss as equals at the bargaining table around, you know, these mandatory items like conditions of work, hours and wages. I think, you know, the Gallup poll last year showed that union approval was at like near historic, like literally in decades has not been as high as it is right now. So, yeah, it's no question that I think these kind of cues have been rippling across the economy. And I mean, you know, not to mention the whole kind of labor shortage and the increased individual power that workers are able to exert in the marketplace right now.
Yeah, how much is that that worker shortage, the labor shortage, tipping the balance in favor of somebody who wants their shop to be unionized?
You know, I think they're not necessarily related directly, but it just speaks to the idea that, workers, I think, fundamentally or have, you know, in some ways people have reevaluated everything after COVID. And it's what do you want from a job? What do you expect from work? I think, you know, consistently people kind of underestimate how bad their job is because of inertia. And it's when they finally start to say, you know, let me look at the opportunities that are out there. You've seen this sort of major, especially at the bottom half of the job market, this major sort of upheaval and sort of people trading up jobs.
I think when people think of the classic private industry union that might be a big factory, the auto plant, the meatpacking facility, whatever it might be. Are we seeing a trend of more service sector unionization these days?
Well, I think there's no question. I mean, again, those are the jobs that are still here in our country, right? And they're the sectors of the economy that traditionally, going back to the, you know, 30s when the U.S. labor movement grew rapidly, were sectors that really weren't involved in that growth at that time. It was in what, you know, heavy manufacturing, et cetera. And yes, I think, you know, these kind of high tech jobs, we had, you know, the Raven organizing with the Activision quality assurance folks here in town. Obviously, we've mentioned the nurses, both the Meritor nurses were in a tough bargain last year and ended up at a strike vote and very near the strike deadline before they reached a settlement. You have the nurses at UW-Madison trying to reform their union. So, I mean, I think that, you know, workers still want a voice at work, and regardless of the sector of the economy. And those, again, those are the jobs that are here, they're still here in the United States. So.
Talking to Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, talking to us about unions these days. Starbucks unions getting a lot of attention now as more stores get unionized, and how we'll get into how unions might affect those who aren't involved in them. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in a unionized workplace? Have you been in your life? What did you think about it? Do you want to be? Are you paying attention to these unionization drives, efforts at Amazon facilities getting attention? Starbucks, we've been talking about that. Colectivo, what our guest mentioned. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, looking at unions and workers' rights and the drive to unionize Starbucks stores, among others. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want your local coffee shop or other service establishment to be unionized? Do you think that is a good thing to see in your community? Have you been involved in a union, maybe even creating a union? Or if you're an employer, what do you think about efforts to unionize various workplaces? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experience at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael, an argument from unions over the years has been, you know, hey, if enough people are unionized, there's a spillover effect where wages go up to non-union employees in the same sector. Was that historically true? Is that something that still bears out?
It is something that still bears out. I mean, the difference in wages is, it depends on the specific sector, but around 10%, it's double digit increase. And it's not even just wages, it's the access to things like healthcare and especially some sort of a retirement plan. That's way higher representation for those benefits in workplaces where the workers have formed unions.
Let's talk about the playing field. There have been changes to labor negotiation rules over the years. Some advances in favor of union efforts, some pushing back on that over the years at the state and federal level. What do you see as the key parts of that story right now?
Well, I guess, I mean, there hasn't been any major reform to labor law literally since the 1950s. There's been many attempts. There's been many politicians run on platforms saying that they were going to change this or that aspect. Even this most recent administration ran on the idea that they were going to implement this Protecting the Right to Organize, or the PRO Act, and so far hasn't seen the light of day. You know, I think workers traditionally have always joined together when they feel like there's inequities. They're looking for equity and voice in their workplace, you know, in balance for the, you know, demand for efficiency from their employers. And again, regardless of how the laws change or come and go, that's kind of the steady constant.
That's the laws, but how about enforcement via things like the National Labor Relations Board?
Oh, well, certainly. I mean, that's the 5-member panel appointed by the president. So clearly the election matters from the respect that the president then has the ability, assuming that the Senate confirms their appointees, which could take us down a whole different rabbit hole. But it's certainly the case that especially over the last three administrations, we've seen both precedents get refined and then reversed and then re-reversed and then re-re-reversed in terms of, for example, the use of employers' email systems for union communications or for communicating with employees about the potential for joining a union. You know, under Obama, there was a decision where that was granted and said basically that's the equivalent of the water cooler of the 50s, right? And people de minimis used email for all sorts of purposes way beyond that of, you know, work. Under the last administration, that got backed up and they said, well, no, we could try to, we can under certain circumstances, if it's consistent that you prohibit it for all, you know, other, you can't sell Girl Scout cookies, you can, you know, that kind of thing. And then now it's the, you know, the new board has reinterpreted, basically putting back into place that standard that was in place from back in the Obama administration. So that's just one example.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ron is with us in Black River Falls. Ron, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Real quick question for your guest. And if you've covered this already, apologize. I was a late comer. I'm curious if you've seen any shift in unions in terms of what their goals are. You know, in the past, unions were really about job protection, and in an environment and economy with lots of jobs and not enough workers, I'm wondering if the goals of the unions themselves are different, say better or more organization towards earning better wages for workers, things like that, rather than just trying to protect jobs. I'll take my answer off the air.
Ron, thanks for the call. Michael?
That's a great question. And I mean, I think we all come to work for money. And of course, wages are always the number one item on any survey that's taken of workers, whether in a bargaining unit or not. I would say I want to unpack the question a little bit by just saying, you know, workers, you know, again, we all have our goals from the employment relationship in terms of, yeah, job security, reliable schedules. You know, we already talked about wages. We'll just stipulate that everybody wants more money. I guess I would say this. I mean, I think especially as you look at some of these organizing drives lately, workers want to make these jobs that you are, they're like family support, like a career, like the baristas, for example. You've heard the kind of this kind of, you know, the myth that, oh, well, that's, you know, low wage jobs or starter jobs or for teenagers. And again, when you look at the data, people are in these jobs for the long term and generally have to work two or three of them to try to get by and make a living. And, you know, I just remember back from an interview with a Colectivo person that was part of their organizing. He said, we work here and we work here every day and we do a valuable service. And these are jobs that we would like to be able to stay in and also have a decent life. And I think from that respect, Ron's question is great because I really do feel like, again, kind of back to the conversation we were having about COVID and people rethinking what they want from the work relationship, I think these new unions are forming around the idea that, yeah, these jobs, you know, before it was get a job in manufacturing and those jobs are gone, it's, well, why can't these jobs be family supporting jobs?
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, looking at the cutting edge of unionization these days, a growing number of Starbucks shops, for example, unionizing. And Michael, one successful vote by organizing at an Amazon plant, which I think for some organizers has been kind of a holy grail. Others have fallen short, though. What are you watching for in this really huge employer that just got, in a lot of ways, got huger during the pandemic?
Yeah, there's no question. This is one that's going to be studied for quite some time. It's interesting from the perspective that this was a total grassroots effort that didn't really receive any support from any of the major established unions in the United States and Canada. We call them international unions, but they're unions that represent workers in both the U.S. and Canada. And they cracked the code by, in essence, doing what unions have always done successfully, which is build community from the bottom up and you know, join together with a common goal of trying to improve their workplace and their working conditions. I mean, that, you know, COVID was kind of the genesis of all of that. It's clear that, you know, I guess I would say that they're at the end of the beginning. The thing that I'm watching for is, yes, they were very successful. Obviously, they succeeded where no one else has in terms of getting a majority of the workers to vote affirmatively that they wanted to form a union. Now their challenge is going to be getting Amazon, once all these challenges and the appeals are done, getting Amazon to the table and trying to bargain this first contract. Because in the United States, that's a daunting hurdle for any union, let alone an independent union.
We've seen over time, despite some of these successful unionizing efforts, a decline in the overall percentage of the workforce unionized in the United States. Right-to-work laws in many states, now including Wisconsin, and things like Act 10 for public employees in Wisconsin, make it harder maybe to get back into that. Do you see that trend, that decline in percent of the workforce unionized, ever going back up in the immediate or near-term future?
I would say, you know, consistently, most of the academics have stated that, you know, there's other models out there from other countries, whether we look at sector bargaining or a bargaining in a more broad base for the community. It's called bargaining for the common good. And you look at some of the unions that have been successful doing that. I'm thinking of the teachers back in 2019 when in West Virginia and many other states, you know, not to mention just down south of here in Chicago, the Chicago teachers had some pretty good success with community partnerships and trying to achieve both, you know, bargaining goals for them, but in general, goals that were trying to help their broader communities. As far as the actual union density numbers changing, time will tell. I mean, there's definitely been a surge in representative elections petitions filed with the NLRB. I mean, a lot of this driven, like you said, by the barista movement, but I think elsewhere as well. And yeah, again, it remains to be seen how successful or how sustainable this is in the longer term. But it's certainly the case that there's been a resurgence in interest, and especially in even the popular, like I said, kind of the zeitgeist now. It's almost like for the younger generation, you know, there's a curiosity that unions are cool now.
Michael, so we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. Take care.
That's Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, with us for a look at unions, Starbucks, and beyond. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, when you take a job, buy stuff, even use a website, you might have to do mandatory binding arbitration. Find out what it means for you tomorrow on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, you might have a Chihuahua with no chill, a German Shepherd who will protect you at all costs, or a Labrador who wants to be friends with everyone. We want to hear from you. Does your dog's personality match up with what you expected from its breed or mix of breeds? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's the deal. Popular knowledge and organizations like the American Kennel Club say, hey, when you're getting a dog, you got to do some research, find out which breeds match up with your lifestyle and personality. If you love spending time on the couch, get a Greyhound. If you've got endless reserves of energy, get a Russell Terrier. According to a new study, though, a lot of these personality traits don't have that much to do with a dog's breed. Researchers at the University of Massachusetts and elsewhere, they surveyed over 18,000 dog owners, and they did genetic testing on a couple thousand dogs to find out what determines dog personality and behavior. Half the dogs in the study are mutts, half are purebred. They found that a dog's breed only accounts for 9% of personality and behavior variation among dogs. More important factors include age and sex. Even those aren't very significant. All right, there's the study. Now we want you, your data. We're talking about your dog, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Does your dog, current dog, past or present dog, does their personality match up with what you'd expect from its breed, the stereotype, or does your dog run contrary, different from what you thought it would be based on the breed? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, we asked around Wisconsin public media. This is going to shock you. When we asked our colleagues about their dogs, they had a lot to say. Hope Kerwin, WPR reporter in La Crosse, says, I have a greyhound. She is the laziest dog I've ever met, which seems to be a common personality trait for her breed. When Hope was first looking to greyhounds, she writes, I was so surprised that they have a reputation for being a 45-mile-per-hour couch potato, and that's definitely what Katie is. She loves a good sprint around the backyard, but spends most of her time asleep on the couch. That doesn't sound too bad. I could live that way. Well, how about you? 800-642-1234. Does your dog's personality match the breed stereotype? Oh, look, lots of you are calling. Fantastic. Connie starts us off in Portage. Connie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to let you know, we've had four English Bulldogs now, and we just got our fourth puppy. Their personalities, all four, were completely different. they really were. This one is just a real little stinker. We can't get her trained. She's bullheaded as heck. She's just totally different than the rest. They were more easygoing. So just to let people know, they're all different.
Connie, I got to ask, though, there's obviously something about English Bulldogs that keeps you coming back for more. What is it?
Oh, because they're so sweet. They are the sweetest, and their face is real squishy, and we just kiss them and hug them, and they're just the sweetest dog ever.
All right. What's the little stinker's name now, the current one?
It should be something awful, but it's Lily.
Lily. Oh, what a nice name. Connie, thank you so much for starting us off at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Ray in Dodgeville. Ray, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to share with us, Ray?
I just wanted to share how quality of a Cavapoo is. I've heard so much about them being affectionate, but I wound up getting one during the pandemic, and it turned out to be a very loving dog. It doesn't take away from other dogs, as I've seen other dogs that the trait has been falsely shown, but it's how you raise them when it comes right down to it. I think even with children, it's how you raise them really shows the difference of how affectionate they're going to really comply with you.
Gotcha. And Ray, I'm sorry, I missed it. What was the breed again?
A Cavapoo. It's a crossbreed between a poodle and a St. Charles Spaniard.
Gotcha. Fantastic, Ray. Thanks for spelling that out for me. We are asking you, based on some current research now, does your dog's personality match up with what you expected from the breed of the dog? Some research says, hey, you know, these breeds, they're pretty recent, historically speaking, and a lot of this behavior is going back thousands of years, so a lot of this personality doesn't come from the breed. We want to hear your firsthand data, 800-642-1234. Okay, your firsthand anecdotes. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. John is with us in Baronet. John, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What's your story, John?
Well, about 5 years ago, my cousin raises German Shepherds up in Escanaba, Michigan, and had one he couldn't sell, so I went and got him. I thought he'd be the perfect dog because I leave, you know, my house is unattended most of the day. Figured he'd be a good yard dog. Well, he's the biggest sissy you've ever met. he's just a big, he thinks he's a lap dog. All he's interested in is chasing his ball, and if a rabbit came up and bit him on the foot, he'd stand there and look dumbfounded. Like, what was that about?
German Shepherd, John. That's a mighty big lap dog.
It's a bite. Yeah, yeah. He wants to climb up there. Like, you know, you can't let him. He weighs about 90 pounds now. So. But, yeah, he didn't turn out anything like, I mean, he's the best dog I ever had. I love him to death. But
awesome.
Not what I was expecting at all.
John, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Appreciate it at 800-642-1234. Jill Nadeau, Larry Mueller Show producer and fill-in host you hear on the air sometimes, says, my rescue dog Seamus is a mix of a lot of breeds, so he's amazing. Well, I don't know if that proves or disproves the science, but it's good to hear about. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Tracy is with us in Spring Green. Tracy, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your dog story, Tracy?
My parents, years ago, got a toy poodle. We actually got it for my mother, who we had always been mutt people. And we'd always gone to the, you know, Humane Society and gotten whatever mutt nobody else wanted. And then my mother, after the last mutt died, made some comment about how she'd always wanted a toy poodle as a girl. And we all sort of scrunched our noses up and said, a toy poodle? But Mother's Day was coming, so we decided to get her, as a surprise, a toy poodle. Well, this toy poodle turned out to be the calmest, most laid-back, silent dog However, he was so laid back and quiet. He kind of kept to himself, but he was affectionate too. And so after having the experience of that dog, when I decided to get a dog of my own, and I was an apartment dweller for many years at that time, I thought, well, I'm going to get one of those. They don't shed. They don't make any noise. They're perfect. And I got my wonderful dog, Fred, who is now gone, and loved him very much. But he was the yappiest, most anxiety-ridden little dog anyone could ever have. And I raised him very similarly to the way my parents raised their dog. And that's just the personality he came with.
Luck of the draw, I guess, Tracy. Thank you so much for sharing both those stories with us. I appreciate it. Let's go to Angela now in Waukesha. Angela, hi.
Hi.
What's your what dog story do you have to share with us, Angela? And does the personality match the expectation?
It does. My husband and I are Chihuahua people, and we have two rescue Chihuahuas, and they are little dogs with a big personality. They like their pack, they like their Chihuahuas, but not other dogs so much, or other people all the time. So they kind of fit the personality that we thought we'd get, and we love them, and we adore them, and all 3 pounds of fluff. They think they're a lot bigger than that.
So. And that's what you wanted going in, Angela, right?
Correct. We love rescues, and we love Chihuahuas a lot. So they're perfect. They're perfect just the way they are.
Wonderful, Angela. Thanks a lot for that. Hey, I have an update on this Cavapoo. Our producers found a picture. It's a pretty adorable dog, actually, I got to say. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Madison now. Hi, Karen.
Hi. So I have 2 mutts. They're primarily American Staffordshire Terrier with other breeds. One of them is kind of a medium-sized dark brindle, and she is the sweetest dog you'll ever meet. She loves everyone. She loves to roll around on the ground and play. Just absolute sweetie. She will bring you toys to share. We call her our little socialist liberal. And then we have another one who is small, mixed with a French bulldog, mostly white, and very, very nervous and very jealous. And she will actually prevent the larger dog from eating because she'll run back and forth between the food dishes because she wants to be the one to control that, even though she has plenty of food. And she'll try and be big and tough, even though she's tiny. And we call her our little Republican because she just can't let anyone else have anything. So, but they're both very sweet dogs when they feel like it.
Karen, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We are talking about your dogs, and you can too at 800-642-1234. A new study says, you know, all those stereotypes we associate with a dog's breed and the personality they have, well, at least according to this one study, there may be other research out there. They matched up genetics and personality and found they don't always match up so well. How about you and your dog, past, present, or future? 800-642-1234. Does your dog match what you stereotype, what you think about that breed? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll get back to more of your calls coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about dog personality. A new study found that breed only accounts for about 9% of a dog's personality. So maybe our stereotypes about a breed and their personality doesn't really always add up. Well, we want to hear your experience at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Sandra is with us in Williams Bay. Sandra, hi.
Hi there.
What's your dog, Sandra?
So my dog is a Louisiana Catahoula. Sometimes they call him a leopard dog because of their markings. He's Blue Merle, and he's a rescue from a ranch in Texas where they were breeding them. And they are the state dog of Louisiana, but not AKC recognized yet, I don't think. So it's a breed in formation, but they're becoming a lot more popular. They're not a huge dog, but they're not small, like around 45 pounds, and just tremendous athletes, super smart, so friendly, He's friendly to other dogs, to people. 100% confidence in his in that. So just great dog.
I love it, Sandra. Thanks a lot. Now, if I recall correctly, the blues legend Clarence Gatemouth Brown has a whole song about a Catahoula, an alligator-eating dog, he calls it. So go find that. Check it out, Sandra. Thanks for calling in. We'll go next to Gretchen in northern Wisconsin. Gretchen, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about Gretchen?
Well, right now I have a mixed terrier, and he's exactly like a terrier. He's a little terrorist. I love it. This is our third terrier. Other ones were Boston Terriers. They pretty much aligned right up with that. But they're all very loving, affectionate dogs, and they know the hand that feeds them. They follow me a lot.
Love. And what's his name, Gretchen?
Rufus.
Rufus. I love it. Thanks so much for sharing that. We are inviting your calls. Does your dog's personality match what you think of for their breed or lack of same? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We asked around Wisconsin Public Media. David Baffa, education producer at PBS Wisconsin. Got two beagles. They both show certain personality traits associated with the breed, an obsession with sniffing and following scents and so on. But they differ in really significant ways. One much more stubborn, one more anxious, one loves chasing toys, the other uninterested in said toys. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Corey is with us in Milwaukee. Corey, hello.
How are we doing today?
Good. What do you got, Corey?
I got Louie. He's a Cocker Spaniel Poodle mix. Mm-hmm. He's man's best friend. He does whatever you want him to do.
And do you expect that going in with a cockapoo, right, they call that?
When I first met him, I think he had his own personality, but we kind of meshed. We worked it out in the middle.
Wait. How much did you change for your cockapoo, Corey?
I probably gave him a little bit more leeway than I should. We're in Milwaukee. We live right off of Brady Street. He is the tail wagging champion of the Brady Street Dog Walk Festival.
Excellent, Corey. Louie trained you well. Thanks for sharing the story at 800-642-1234. Rana is with us now in Cameron. Rana, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. We have his and her dogs at our house. My husband wanted a Brittany Spaniel. It matches his personality perfectly. They're both running around trying to do too many things at once, chasing their ball. Oh, there goes a rabbit. Got to go that way. And they are just overly ambitious. My little mutt is a Welsh Corgi and Schnauzer Cross. So she's wonderful, loving, a little protective, great at wagging her tail and making friends with everybody. So we have one of the true breed and one Mutsky. And my vote is for the Mutsky always.
Rana, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. We are taking your calls about your dogs, their personality, and how they match or don't match what people might expect from the breed of dog or the mutt nature of the dog. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kelly joins us next in Madison. Kelly, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Kelly?
Well, I first of all think it's kind of a disservice to frame that study the way that it said that that if dog breed doesn't really affect the temperament, because I adopted a little farm puppy, a border collie, Australian cattle dog mix, thinking with that mindset that, oh, it's all how you raise them, you just train them, you socialize them, and you can have the kind of dog that fits in your life with your family. But she, despite all the socializing and all the training, she's still a cattle dog. And I stand up border collie. Like, all of those traits come through. The high energy, neurotic, always want something to be occupying her mind.
I gotcha, Kelly. You're kind of breaking up, but I think we take the point. Your dog does match what you'd expect, that standard in terms of behavior. And again, the researchers aren't saying 0% match. They're just saying maybe not as much as we might think. Thanks again, Kelly, for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Gretchen joins us next in Eau Claire. Gretchen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You've got what, Gretchen?
I've got a rough-coated collie. He's my first dog, and I'm 65. But anyway, he's so loyal and sweet and gentle, and he's the peacemaker around the house. No arguments allowed, so he steps between anybody who's not getting along. And he's just, I don't know, so smart and intuitive and so loyal.
And Gretchen, did you, when you were getting a collie, did you do it for that reason? You were hoping to get that loyal, intelligent peacemaker?
Well, I didn't know exactly. My uncle had a miniature collie when I was growing up, so that's about the only thing that was stuck in my mind. And I wanted a big dog, and Kai is huge. He's about 85 pounds. So, yeah. Anyway.
I love
everything I wanted and more. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad to hear it, Gretchen. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. We are taking your dog stories for just another few minutes. The personality, the breed, do they match in your mind? 800-642-1234. Christiana is with us now in Appleton. Christiana, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Christiana?
I have a chihuahua, and she really likes to lick everybody, which is not what you'd expect from a chihuahua.
Right, because people, I think of chihuahuas as kind of like yipping at people and, standoffish, and I'm, they're tougher than you are. But yours is more friendly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love it. Thank
people
you.
Like her.
Sounds like a fun dog, Christiana. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Rick is with us next. Now, Rick, what's your dog?
I have a golden retriever, and I guess I'd just like to make the comment, although it's certainly true that any dog can have a specific personality, working dogs that have been bred, particularly the sporting dogs or herding dogs, or when I say sporting dogs, I mean the retriever breeds, they're bred specifically to be part of the team, the way we work the dogs in the same way that herding dogs work. And I think that's why you'll find the popularity of golden retrievers. They want to be part of the team as opposed to, let's say, pointers, which have been bred for hundreds of years for different things where they work independently. And they're sort of, I wouldn't say indifferent, but less inclined to sort of want the teamwork. So I'm not sure what that study was looking at in terms of personalities. But if you talk to professional dog trainers that work with working animals, not show dogs, but working animals, they'll tell you there is a definite difference in not only their behavior, but particularly instincts. So the retrievers want to retrieve, the pointers want to point, the hounds want to track. And it's just an observation anecdotally, but I believe it to be true.
Rick, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Harry joins us now in Hayward. Harry, hello.
Gosh, I'm hitting up again on a shout out on the golden retrievers, but yes, I'll sort of paraphrase what the previous caller said, and they are sniffers. They will pick stuff up, but they will also sell their soul for a tennis ball. And their loyalty is one that I had a golden that when I was up on a roof working on a roof, she would try to get up on a ladder and got up about three rungs. So they are they're good dogs, and they've changed my personality to theirs. So that's what I can say for the goldens.
Excellent. Harry, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Thanks to everyone who called in. I appreciate it. A lot of great stories. Maybe in trouble with my coworkers now. A lot of them shared stories that I didn't have time for because you called in. But hey, listen on. I might share some more other stories over the course of the next week. And by the way, there is still time to share your story of your dog's personality and whether you think it matches up with what you expected when you got it based on, the breed and background and whatnot. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Always happy to hear more dog stories along the way. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, are we likely to find life on other planets? And if not, should we plant it there? A UW biologist looks at some of the practical and ethical questions around some of this terraforming. I'm a big science fiction fan. Love to hear from a scientist about this. Plus, it's a great time to get outside, but be sure to take some precautions against ticks and Lyme disease. We'll get practical advice from a DNR Lyme disease expert. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.